Hello, everyone. So nice to be with you today. Thank you for joining us for our fourth annual Markets Conversation with KKR's Henry McVey and Salita Marcelli. I'm Anthony Pastore. Thanks for joining us and in the studio here today. I wanted to, first of all, welcome both of you. It's nice to have you. This is our fourth in this series that we've been doing. It's really cool to have you both back. Henry, nice to see you. Salita, also good to see you as well. Henry, I want to get right to your outlook for 2026. KKR and you put out a report titled High Grading. I want to get into what that means for you. It's suggesting to investors to upgrade what they have in their portfolio, not just get out and do other things or get out completely. So walk us through some of the thinking that went into high grading and why it's so important right now for portfolios.
Okay, well, great. It's great to be back here again. So thank both of you. It's one of my highlights of the year. So this should be a great dialogue. There's lots going on. So the past couple of years, we've been talking about this glass half full, and our expectation was that investors were going to underappreciate the level of growth and the potential for margin and multiple expansion because of productivity. I think coming into 2026, some of that was in the price. And what we saw from our analytics coming into this year was two things that made us a little bit cautious. One was the embedded growth rate on the S&P was already up to 16%. It typically is a historical average of about 11. In the last decade, it was 8. So it had doubled. So expectations about growth were up and they were in the tech sector. And the second is that people had gotten used to essentially no defaults in credit. And we thought that credit defaults would start to tick up. I want to come back to that. That was the kind of cautionary tale. The positive was the ability to high grade the portfolio or upgrade it was extraordinarily cheap. And so in equities, everybody had concentrated in tech, and there was the ability to buy quality as the market breadth widened, which I think is what's unfolding at about a 20% discount, which you don't get that often. So it's a little like going to the grocery store and having something on sale. And then on the credit side, let's use triple B's versus triple A's, you could upgrade the quality of the portfolio, big jump from triple B's to triple A's for 60, only cost you 60 basis points in spread. That historical average is usually 150 to 200. So it felt like to me the prudent thing to do when we pulled all our analytics together globally was to come up with a thesis about upgrading the portfolio or high grading. Our message is not to get out of the market. We still see pretty robust earnings growth, pretty good GDP growth, but we did want to reflect a change where, as before, I think we'd had kind of glass half full sentiment was too cautious. That wasn't our view coming into this year.
Yeah. And you know, you mentioned credit defaults, and I think it's really important to bring it up because you are talking about, and we know we're late in the credit cycle, so money's a little bit more expensive, lenders are being a little bit more prudent. Are credit defaults a risk here?
I think what you're going to see, and you're seeing this across the public bank market, bank loan market, and private credit, is that you are seeing a tick up in defaults. Mm-hmm. That's really not where I'm focused. I think we're going to have a credit default cycle, not a crisis.
Okay.
What I do think is going to be problematic is I think the recoveries when things go wrong are going to be lower. And so what we've really been focused on is like, where is the potential where defaults go up, but recoveries are going to be low? Typically, you recover about 60 to 70% of a default. I think some instances, and we can get into specifics, I know there's a lot of concern around software, is going to be that the recoveries in certain parts of the market are lower. And so it really speaks to me on the credit side, not to abandon credit, mm-hmm. but to approach it with a really diversified portfolio. I think where you get in trouble in credit is you really concentrate. Concentration is for equities, not for credit.
Right. We could do a whole show on just the software story, which has been really blowing up a lot lately. So, Lita, let me bring you in. So last year, the CIO, we put out our year ahead report and we titled it Escape Velocity. Yeah. And it was published in November. So we're a few months from publishing date. It was talking about AI innovation. It was talking about easing monetary policy, fiscal spending, which has helped markets and economies. Fast forward now to almost in March, does that story still resonate? Where are we inside that cycle?
Yeah. Thank you, Anthony. Great to be here with you again. We actually published an updated version of it in January as well. But I would say, Anthony, so far the year is actually unfolding pretty much like we expected, right? You have AI and policy tailwinds still supporting the global economy. And looking ahead, the outlook is quite constructive. Now, we anticipate a friendly policy mix here. While Fed cuts are probably going to come later than we hoped, the direction is still towards easing. And we also have the one big beautiful bill stimulus from DC that is coming in. And in this election year, policy focus is very much likely going to stay on affordability, right? And then you have AI, which remains a driver, you know, a really powerful driver, actually, in the market. The AI spending make up more than 2% of GDP, which is a huge jump compared to what it was last year. And the technology is evolving to benefit more sectors. And, you know, finally, you know, I would say consumption is healthy, mainly led by higher income households, while, you know, policy measures could certainly support lower income groups as well. So when you put it all together, right, what do we have? We have strong growth, we have supportive policy, we have maturing AI, and that creates a really nice backdrop, but it also explains why the market leadership is shifting, right? We are moving from a pretty narrow focus on building AI infrastructure to a more holistic view as these business models get disrupted and the cyclical growth story plays out. What are we doing at UBS? Well, we're adjusting accordingly. We still like the AI theme. We still like the US market, but we are diversifying now more broadly. So we recently trimmed our exposure to the technology sector, to communication services as well. And we're favoring healthcare, financials, utilities, and consumer discretionary. We also see opportunities outside of the US, both in Europe and in Asia, where policy is also supportive, where AI innovation is also shaping up and probably at cheaper valuations. When it comes to credit, I think the way Henry laid out is really great. I second that in the sense that our focus is also very much on high quality. We're trying to avoid getting exposure to excessive risk, especially in high yield, where spreads are quite tight. We like a mix of high-grade corporates and agency mortgage-backed securities that give you a nice protection and lower correlation to the equity markets. And private credit, I still think, has a complementary role to play in terms of boosting income. So that's where we are in our outlook.
Great to hear it. Yeah. And in the AI story, obviously, it's one of those that it exponentially changes, seems like day to day, week to week. So the story continues. And speaking of all those sectors that you mentioned, utilities, healthcare, that's such a fascinating story for investing, which we could get into. Henry, the last time you were here with us almost a year ago, we talked about regime change, which is one of your themes. And, you know, you suggest that forward looking expected returns are compressing, that stock bond correlations are elevated. Essentially, you know, people think their money isn't going to go as far as it did before. And stocks and bonds are moving together more than they usually do. What do you think is driving those dynamics, and how do you think that advisors and clients should be calibrating portfolios given what we know?
Right. So I think our regime change thesis was something we laid out after COVID.
And right.
There are a couple of things that we saw. One was governments are running with bigger fiscal deficits. You see that everywhere that I travel around the world. Second is you have heightened geopolitics. Third thing is, given that AI is a national security concern, you have a kind of a messy energy transition. People want to go to renewables, but they need energy today. And then you've got a little bit of sticky or at least more volatile inflation. Those are the four kind of legs to the stool that we see around the regime change. So what have we done in private equity? We're more focused on corporate carve-outs and public to privates, where we're kind of making our own luck. There's more of an operational improvement versus just betting on low rates. Second is we're doing much more in real assets. And I would highlight infrastructure has been a huge growth area for KKR globally. We see that debt indebtedness from the governments. They want to move more to the private sectors. You people had a really good experience around inflation protection that that infrastructure provided during right after COVID in 21 and 22. And now we've started to add back some real estate into that, given that valuations have come down. And then in the credit markets, we really like something called asset-based finance. Again, you're getting long nominal GDP with some pricing power. So what I would say is, given where we are with a little more inflation in the system, more volatility, bigger deficits, we want to own more things linked to nominal GDP. We want to have, you know, make our own luck through more operational improvement. And, you know, Salita's written and talked about this, but the public markets are concentrated. Mm. And so what we're trying to do is build diverse portfolios in the private side that are really, I'd say, more stable relative to some of that concentration that you've seen in tech. And it doesn't mean tech's not going to work, but I think we're in a different environment than we were in 2021 and 2022.
Right. What about you, Salita? Do you see any structural changes when it comes to investing today versus, you know, what Henry was talking about the last couple of years? Obviously, a lot has changed.
Yeah. In recent years, we've been talking a lot about the 5Ds that impact markets. Like, what are those 5Ds? Deglobalization, debt, digitalization, demographics, and decarbonization. So I'm not going to go through each one of them. Don't worry. I think they're all self-explanatory. But what I would say is, when you put them all together, I think they point to two significant shifts. One is, expect more volatility in the macro environment, right? Inflation expectations could be very much on a seesaw with, deficits and deglobalization on one hand, and then AI-driven productivity gains on the other. Growth is also less predictable with supply chains evolving and AI creating more dispersions across different regions. So that's one shift. And the second shift, I would say, is we are in a period of rapid investments that is mainly driven by technological breakthroughs, but also by necessity, that is driven by demographic shifts. And I think Henry talks a lot about this, defense needs that now require really new solutions, right? So what does that mean for investors? I think it means two things. Number one, you need diversification on steroids. Diversification between equity and bonds is table stakes, but it's not enough. As we all know, gold certainly has gained renewed relevance in the midst of rising geopolitical tensions and increased central bank purchases. So that's one. Two is what Henry talked today about already, but I know that historically we've spent a lot of time on this, is you've got to look at private real estate and infrastructure where you can get inflation-linked cash flows, right? And I would say, the third part is, you know, I think hedge funds certainly matter more when you have greater macro and policy volatility. So that's one of my second thing that investors should think about, I think, is you've got to get exposure to these big investment waves through both public and private markets, right? When it comes to AI, it's no longer just about the big household names. You've got to look at data centers, you know, industrial equipment and energy solutions, especially when energy or electricity demand, I should say, is surging, right? Data centers are expected to make up about 9% of the overall U.S. electricity usage by 2035, up from 4% today. So that's an important theme. The other theme is, of course, longevity that we've been talking for a while. By 2030, our expectation is that the revenue globally coming from this segment could reach $8 trillion compared to $5 trillion we've seen only just a few years ago. And that is driven, you know, by strong demand, of course, for obesity therapies,
right,
oncology and medical devices. And I would say the private side of it, I think private equity is very well positioned to support, to help for, you know, in areas like next gen care delivery, personalized medicine, and of course, digital health.
Yeah. The story on AI, when you go back to that for a second, you talked about the data centers and all the utilities. It's almost everything nowadays, even in the small and mid-cap space, somehow is has some kind of a connection to AI. It's unbelievable how there are so many AI adjacent sectors and companies that are really being wholly affected. Yep. We use it every day here at UBS in our research and other things that we're doing. And I never thought that we would adopt it so quickly. So it's a great story. Henry, KKR, you saw some record fundraising, also deployment last year. Where do you see attractive opportunities right now in private markets? Because as Salita said, there is a recommended allocation from CIO, roughly 10 to 20% of privates in a portfolio, depending on risk tolerance. Where do you see private markets today?
So I'd say there are a couple of things that jump out. One is around private equity, as I mentioned before, corporate carve-outs. Like, we're not going to have, in my view, a huge M&A boom the way we did in 2000. But what we are having is we're in a bull market for corporate repositioning. Companies are feeling pressure from activists. They want to get the return on capital up, you know, capital heavy to capital light. And so what's happening, I'd say the U.S. and Japan are the two epicenters, where these are areas where they typical company might have 500 to 1,000 subsidiaries. Mm. They can't all be core. And so we've been able to come in with our operational toolkit and improve those. The second is this whole idea, again, on the debt side of capital heavy to capital light. If you look at deals we've done where PayPal, Harley-Davidson, other type of home building companies all the way into Europe, where they want to increase the return on capital, they want to reinvest and grow. So we're able to come in and buy their receivables in a very targeted way and create income for investors. And so I know there's a lot of noise around direct lending and software. I mean, one alternative to that is the asset-based finance world, where really you're buying hard assets that are linked to nominal GDP. The third thing I would highlight is, again, infrastructure. I just got back from India, you know, Europe. We're seeing, whether it's data, it's power grids, that stuff that Salita talked about, that is in a secular bull market where you want to have exposure to that. And then I'll leave you with one last idea. There's a supply-demand imbalance around what we call capital solutions at KKR, which is, think about a company that doesn't want to issue equity. Their stock price may be down, but they need capital, and they're willing to do a convertible or a mandatory convertible or preferred, and you're getting a return that is almost what you would get in an equity, but you have a lot more visibility on that return. I help to run risk at KKR too, and what I see is a supply-demand imbalance there. And so those would be four ideas that I think are actionable today where investors in the private markets can perform. And again, the key to private market investors is to do what your financial advisor at UBS is saying. It's like, be disciplined, diversify, don't try to time the market, all the things that you guys talk about. I just want to reiterate that. Yeah. from the seats at KKR, we're in absolute agreement with what UBS has been saying. And we like to have partners like you that take a long-term view on that. Don't try to buy a concentrated credit fund. Don't try to get all your private equity out in 1 year. Just be disciplined around that. Let the illiquidity premium work for you. Follow the asset allocation that Salita and the team are kind of putting out for you. And I think the outperformance will come.
Yeah. And piggybacking off of that then, Salita, what opportunities do you see right now as attractive in private markets?
Okay.
And what are you hearing from advisors too? That's a question that I think would be relevant, because I know you do talk to advisors a lot. What are they saying about this?
So maybe I'll just start with private equity.
Yeah.
So in private equity, we actually think the improving IPO and M&A activity will unlock value. We're very much focused on middle markets where valuation seems to be more reasonable and leverage is lower. We particularly like those managers that have a value bias and try to drive returns from operational improvements, rather than multiple expansion of our financial leverage. So value creation through execution is very much key for us there. So that's private equity. Private, or I would say infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So infrastructure, look, I think that sits at the intersection of many of the Ds that I just talked about when you asked the prior question. So there are actually quite interesting and plenty of opportunities, I think, there. So one thing is demand for digital infrastructure, so cell towers, fiber, data centers, etc. They are certainly outpacing supply So that creates an opportunity. Also, renewable energy is interesting again because the cost of technology, cost of solar is coming down. And then, you know, I would say, you know, shifting supply chains and this push for self-sufficiency is certainly driving investments for transportation and logistics. Mm. So those are the areas we're looking at in infrastructure. Private credits. That's where we get most of the questions from our clients and from advisors, obviously, given the headlines. Now, I'd say when I look at the overall asset class, overall fundamentals, I think they're still in quite solid place. And it still provides an attractive income opportunity, for portfolios. But maybe needless to say, selectivity is really, really important because, spreads are tight, competition is, very steep, and we are already seeing dispersion mm-hmm. among managers, right? And, also stress is building up. We're seeing stress in sort of the lower to middle markets, in that sector. And I would say in this environment, it is quite possible to see underwriting standards slip, especially when this field has become really crowded. So, manager selection is a very critical part of risk management, I think, in everything, but particularly in private credit today. And we're very much focused on experienced managers mm-hmm. that are focused on large, high-quality borrowers and also sort of senior and sponsored back loans.
Right. It also feels like the it got crowded pretty quickly, as you were saying. It's kind of a little overcrowded. Henry, I have to ask you, Salita kind of alluded to it a little bit. There is this kind of recent headline panic about software, about private credit. And, in the seat that you sit in every day, is there any merit to this? Is it warranted? Is it maybe overblown? What are your thoughts on all the latest headlines that are happening right now?
Look, I think this is where the private markets and the public markets are the same, which is the same way that you believe in dollar cost averaging on mm-hmm. the public markets. We at KKR believe in linear deployment. Mm-hmm. If you have a four-year fund, do it over 4 years. Don't do it over two. I've talked about sector diversification. We typically own 100-plus credits in our private credit, so you want to diversify that. And then ultimately, you want to be higher up in the capital structure, I think, with bigger companies. So Salita hit on this, but typically we try to underwrite things that are $150 million or more. So I think there's the signal and the noise. I still think it's a attractive asset class, but I would, I obviously from KKR's purchase, we've been in the alts business. We started it 50 years ago. So we probably have learned some lessons the hard way along the way. And you're not going to see us come to market with something where we're a sector focused fund or we're mm-hmm. trying to put all the money out in 2 years. And I think that discipline is going to pay dividends for what KKR does for its limited partners. So that's the way I would answer that. Ultimately, to make me think we're going to have a real credit cycle, I did say that I think recoveries are going to be lower. That's where I would focus, is you'd have to really have a fall off in corporate profitability and unemployment, which is not our base case or UBS's base case for this year. But again, they're just simple rules of the road. Privates can earn you the illiquidity premium, but you need to be disciplined about that. And we're committed to doing that. And I think we want to do it alongside people like you that allow the investor to have a good experience.
Yeah. And you and your colleagues bring in years of experience in the space as well. Yes, Salita.
If I can chat,
please, yeah.
The software, since I fielded a lot of questions specifically on this lately. I think some of the panic around private credit and software in the public, in the markets is a bit overdone, mm-hmm. right? Because when I look at the managers in our platform and their underlying software companies, by and large, they're actually in pretty good shape. So similar to, I don't expect an imminent crisis there. That said, I think some repricing of risk was and is quite reasonable because software attracted enormous amount of capital in 2021 and 2022. And I think it's safe to assume that not all the loans that were underwritten at that point were done, with the understanding of the pace of AI that we know today, right? And I think over the next sort of months and years, we are going to see a dispersion between borrowers with or without a pretty strong AI moat. So I think, you know, those software, you know, some of the software companies that could be easily commoditized will be the most vulnerable. That's what we're looking at. It's those that, you know, create dashboards, aggregate data, or automate pretty basic workflow. I think they're going to be vulnerable. On the other hand, mission critical software that is embedded in, you know, operating systems that are built around proprietary data, I think those will stay quite resilient. So from our perspective, you know, how quickly the technology evolves is key. But even if the technology evolves really fast, you still have a real friction in terms of adoption, right? Because of, you know, enterprise integration, regulation, data security. So our base case is really not a, you know, one big stressful period, but maybe, you know, several waves over the next few years, and you might see pockets of stress, but it's, again, I don't think it's a systematic event.
Great. Thank you, Salita.
At this point.
Henry, just kind of switching gears a little bit, one of the stories that you wrote in your recent paper was talking about how, in your high grading paper, was talking about how you had just graduated from Wharton in 1997, the business school, then you returned to the workforce, 1997 again, we were in the start of the tech boom. And I also started in the business in 1997, and I was like, wow, is it always like this? You know, and then of course you realize 2 years later or 3 years later, it's really not. So with you now kind of having that experience under your belt, when you think about artificial intelligence as an investment in general, where do you kind of think about, like when you're thinking about KKR strategy and using AI or investing in AI, how does it sit with you?
Well, I'll start. It does feel a lot like the 90s. In 2022, we had the bond market got hit. Same thing happened in 94. Everybody moved to the sidelines. That was the opportunity to buy. And nobody really understood productivity. My take on this cycle is that if you think about it right now, we actually started to see in our portfolio companies, remember we have 200 data points because we own all these companies.
Right.
We started to see digitalization, automation, machine learning. That's what's been driving the productivity boom thus far. Now you're starting to see AI, but it's less than 20% of the boom that we're seeing. And by the way, productivity has doubled this decade relative to the prior decade. What I would say is this one has more of a debt focus than an equity focus. So there was, you know, pets.com and this, that, and the other.
Right.
And remember that a lot of the focus in during that period was thinking about who were the tech enablers. What I think is going to happen the same way that at that period you wanted to buy Amazon because it was actually an application of the internet. I would be focused on the value shifting from the enablers to the applications of that. And that's why we're spending more time around industrials, parts of healthcare services, and we're doing this globally. So there's kind of the headline, and I'm very bullish, as we said, on the data build out and the power demand. But some of these companies are not going to cut the mustard around AI. Mm. And so what we're trying to do is like, what can you own that doesn't have an AI rating, multiple on it, and then you can bring that technology. And as I go around the world, the performing companies are not the ones that are just the AI hot dot. What they are is the ones that are embedding the technology deep into the system where you create AI knowledge on the vertical. Financial services is a great industry for doing that. Those are the software companies that are going to do well. Those are the AI companies that are going to do well. And most importantly, those are the enterprises that are going to perform. And so we're going to have this period right now where we're in the fog of war. But what you're going to see is you're coming out of the other side, you're going to see some great companies across financial services, consumer. And I was around when E-Trade was going to put UBS and Merrill Lynch out of business because financial advice was going to be a commodity. We're in a bull market for financial advice. Mm-hmm. The same way that you think about Amazon, you know, and Walmart. Walmart is a critical, what they do around AI and technology. Home Depot, these are amazing companies that embrace technology. This is going to be another wave of that. And if you can find those companies that are trading at decent valuations and bring that AI expertise, That's what's going to really be exciting, both in the private markets and the public markets. By the way, we have a staff, we have an in-house staff of kind of McKinsey experts, where every company, and it's called KKR Capstone, we go to every company and we're taking that knowledge and doing a diagnostic across our portfolio companies. We're not going to get all of it right, but think about the flywheel and the network that we're building as you do that across 25 offices globally and 200 portfolio companies. So there's a fail forward and a learning aspect, kind of that this flywheel that I think you're starting to see revenue per employee at our portfolio companies. And also, we don't have time to go through it. My group in particular is doing some really interesting stuff around AI that's helping our deal sourcing, as well as our execution and our currencies and things like that. So it's a robust topic, and there'll definitely be winners and losers. And you just got to tilt towards what I think are the logical long-term drivers.
Yeah, long-term innovation is real, essentially.
Yeah.
And it's here to stay.
And the 60s had productivity, the 90s had productivity. We're having productivity after a decade of not having that. A lot of people who've invested, who are in the market right now, actually haven't gotten the benefits of that. These cycles operate differently. And I think there's a real opportunity to guide your investors to these kind of long-term winners and not speculate, because ultimately a stock is its current earnings in perpetuity, then some value assigned to the future growth.
Yeah.
Don't get burned by over-assigning too much value to the future growth. And I think that's where we're trying to spend time at KKR to make sure we get that right on the private side.
Well, to have you come back and talk more about that in depth. I think that's a really interesting conversation. Thanks, Henry. Before I let you both go, something that you both have in common is you travel quite extensively internationally for your jobs, also for personal vacation time. I hope that you both get sometime soon. But just, Salita, when you travel throughout the world, you're in Asia, Europe, everywhere, what do you take back with you when you come back to the States? What's the sort of the feeling out there when it comes to investing? What are clients thinking about? What are, you know, advice for financial professionals thinking about outside of the borders of the United States?
Yeah. So you mentioned the beginning. We've been doing this, Henry, for 4 years.
4 years.
It's now our tradition.
She travels more than I do.
But wait,
I used to have a lead, but she's taken it.
Every year, this question really goes to Henry because he gets to go to the cool places.
But now it's yours.
Well, this year, just to prepare for this question, I did a world tour twice over. So I'm ready.
Okay.
So joking aside, I did spend quite a bit of time in Asia recently. Shanghai to Hong Kong, Singapore, whatever, Australia, and even Japan. So I would say one takeaway for me is obviously we have a location in our portfolios, but let's talk about a typical investor. I think one cannot avoid this part of the world in their investments as part of their strategic, I think, asset allocation. And I think when you're there, it hits you even more. So I've been to other cities a bunch of times, but I actually went to Shanghai for the first time in 20 years. And I couldn't recognize, obviously, part of the city and all the advancements that has happened. And while I was there in Shanghai, I attended the UBS Greater China Conference. And what struck me was, of course, Gen AI was on the agenda, but it certainly was not the headline. The buzz was all around how in China, AI is shaping industries like mobility. So robotaxis, the cost of it in China is about 1/5 of the US. And also the other hot topic was around humanoid robotics. And first of all, in terms of robotaxis, I think with the way the supply chains are and the more efficiency that they have around production, that's obviously driving this cost. And then humanoid robotics, there's a very strong belief that China can commercialize that pretty fast, especially on factory floors. So just want to be careful. I mean, when I say this, I'm not saying you should just put all your money in China. Certainly, that's not the message. One really needs to stick with, long-term asset allocation. Henry said it. He seems to like our strategic asset allocation too. So that message is there. But my message is actually broader than that, which is it's important to make sure one does not have, when investing, blinders on, because there's also a lot of great innovation that is happening outside of the U.S. as well.
Right.
And in our portfolios in UBS right now, we are leading to certain, you know, areas within Asia, for example, China tech, Japan and Singapore markets. You also asked what else we're taking away. Great shopping in Tokyo.
And hopefully great food too, I can imagine.
Definitely.
Yikes, the cuisine must be incredible. Yes. Thanks, Alita. Yes. Henry, I know you were in India recently, yep, traveling with some colleagues. Yep. What was it like for you? What did you take away from that?
So I think about our Asia footprint. I usually over-index to Japan, as Alita said. That's our corporate reform story. Yeah. So that's probably 25 to 30% of our Asia private equity. The other big one is India consumption upgrade. And that story is alive and kicking, and particularly the middle to upper income, financial services, education, healthcare services. That is really, we're seeing an acceleration in that. I think for us, the other big thing in India is we've been there since early 2000s on private equity. Our infrastructure business, a lot of the same themes that we talked about, which is data build out, not enough power, renewables. I mean, that part of the world is on fire, and the government wants, they need tax revenue, so they're moving more stuff into the private market. So that is a big, those are two big things. I would say globally, what I'm watching though is that we've been in a world about global trade, and that's what everybody's talking about on tariffs. I think the next chapter of globalization may be global services. And we can come back and talk about this, but the US and India are kind of leading that. Certainly Japan has some of that, but Europe needs to speed up there. And I think China needs to speed up there. So I think there is some differentiation around having a consumption economy, exporting services instead of goods, and that's something. And then then tying that into the infrastructure to make sure all that can get around. And so that's a big meaty theme, but that's a huge part of our focus in Asia. And what you're seeing is Asia trade is exploding. If you think about Europe or the US, it's about 70% kind of interregional trade with the Americas and Europe, and that number in Asia is 45%. So all the things that you said stick out, and that's happening. The good news, I had the same reaction that Salita did, which is most of global investors actually don't have enough allocation to the region. So I'm not saying go, you know, put all your money in it tomorrow, but I can tell you that big global institutional money is overweight the US at a time that international earnings are breaking out, and that breadth is going to pull people in, and it's going to re-rate valuations.
Excellent. Henry, thank you very much.
No, it's an honor.
Good to have you back.
Great to be with you guys. It's a real tradition to get to come here, the new studio, and just the partnership.
Thank you.
It's very much appreciated.
We look forward to having you. And thanks, Henry. Salita, always a pleasure to see you. Thank you also to both of your teams for helping coordinate everything here. Maybe it won't be a year this time. Maybe it'll be every six months.
Easy. I'll come back when you guys. I just need to get Salita back in New York so we can actually.
We have to keep you on the ground a little bit. Thank you both again. Great to see you. And thanks for joining us. That's all the time we have for this terrific conversation with Salita and Henry. Of course, I want to thank you all for spending this time with us. And we look forward to another strong year of programming ahead from our chief investment office and our great partners like KKR. Until then, we'll keep you updated with all the latest views from our House View publications, our blogs, alerts, and our videos, as well as our podcast. And as always, we encourage you to continue this conversation with your financial advisor here at UBS. Thanks for joining us, everybody. I'm Anthony Pastore from New York City. Have a great rest of your day. Thanks.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliates. The views and opinions expressed in this material by external guest speakers are those of the author, speaker, and are not those of UBS, its subsidiaries, or affiliates. Accordingly, UBS does not accept any liability over the content of this material or any claims, losses, or damages arising from the use or reliance of all or any part thereof. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient, and is published for informational purposes only. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.